On behalf of New Hampshire Public Radio and the wider community of poets, I'm proud to present Tracy K. Smith with the 2018 Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon Prize in American Poetry.
Thank you so much. I am so deeply grateful for this beautiful recognition and the generosity of the award. I'm incredibly startled to hear that list of names and hear my own name there among poets who have been my teacher and just people who have made the craft seem real, necessary, and powerful for me. I also want to talk just a tiny bit about my gratitude for the work of Donald Hall and Jane Kenyon. I see them as two great American poets whose beautiful sensitivity and vulnerability to life and all of its layers, all of its shapes and forms, has taught so many people, and I include myself, how to think about not just language, but about life and pain and joy, loss and gratitude. I'd like to maybe just open with a poem by Jane Kenyon by way of thank you. This is a poem called Evening Sun. Why does this light force me back to my childhood? I wore a yellow summer dress, and the skirt made a perfect circle, turning and turning until it flared to the limit, was irresistible. The grass and trees, my outstretched arms, and the skirt whirled in the ochre light of an early June evening. And I knew then that I would have to live and go on living. What sorrow it was, and still, what sorrow ignites but does not consume my heart. I love that she brings us to a place that's so beautiful and that's also so aware of pain. And those last three lines, and still, what sorrow ignites but does not consume my heart. I feel like poetry gives us opens up a space where we can make something productive of those feelings and those contradictions. So I'm deeply grateful and honored. Thank you. Of course, I'd love to share some of my own work. I thought I would read some poems from Wade in the Water, which is the book in which I feel myself thinking about the present, thinking about America, thinking about our fraught sense of fear, particularly across lines of racial difference, thinking about our fraught relationship with the planet. And my way of grappling with that has been to look backward toward history and to ask voices from an earlier time period to present themselves as newly useful. But maybe first I'll start with a poem that is rooted in now. This is called Annunciation. I feel ashamed, finally, of our magnificent paved roads, our bridges slung with steel, our vivid glass, our tantalizing lights, everything enhanced, rehearsed, a trick. I've turned old. I ache most to be confronted by the real, by the cold, the pitiless, the bleak, by the red fox crossing a field after snow, by the broad shadow scraping past overhead. My young son, eyes set at an indeterminate distance, ears locked, tuned inward, caught in some music only he has ever heard. Not our cars, our electronic haze, not the piddling bleats and pings that cause some hearts to race. Ashamed, like a pebble, hard and small, hoping only to be ground to dust by something large and strange and cruel. And maybe just thinking about the way that the natural world runs through Hall and Kenyon's poems, maybe I'll read you one poem that is an homage. I think I've lived most of my adult life in New York City, and 4 years ago I left New York for Princeton, New Jersey, which is this idyllic town with foxes, the one in the poem that's a real fox, and trees and deer and birds and quiet and light, and I feel so close to the holy there. Here's a poem that is thinking about nature. Maybe it gets there indirectly. This is called The Angels. Two slung themselves across chairs once in my motel room, grizzled in leather biker gear, emissaries for something I needed to see. I was worn down by an awful panic, a wrenching in the gut, contortions. They sat there at the table while I slept. I could sense them with a deck of playing cards between them. To think of how they smelled, what comes to mind is rum and gasoline. And when they spoke, though I couldn't, I dared not look. I glimpsed how one's teeth were ground down almost to nubs, which makes me hope some might be straight up thugs. Young, slim, raw, who bounce and roll with fearsome grace, whose very voices cause faint souls to quake. Quake then, fools, and fall away. What God do you imagine we obey? Think of the toil we must cost them, one scaled perfectly to eternity, and still they come, telling us through the ages not to fear. Just those two, that once, and never again for me since, though there are there sightings, flashes, hints, a proud tree in vivid sun, branches swaying in strong wind, rain hurling itself at the roof, boulders, mounds of earth mistaken for dead does, lions in crouch, a rust-stained pipe where a house once stood, which I take each time I pass it for an owl. Bright whirl, so dangerous and near. My mother sat whispering with it at the end of her life, while all the rooms of our house filled up with night. I'll leap to one of the poems that's really rooted in history, and it's also one of the handful of poems in the book that are drawn from actual historical documents, either in what I think of as kind of a collage or as a kind of redacted or erasure poem. This is a poem that's drawn from letters that African-American soldiers gave or wrote to Abraham Lincoln and to their family members during the Civil War. And it's also composed of deposition statements that black veterans, their widows, and descendants gave after the war in an attempt to claim pension. And this was a difficult request to make for people who had been enslaved because they didn't have birth certificates, they didn't have marriage licenses, and they didn't have documentation to verify their identity after they had changed their names as a result of emancipation. So there was a very sad, you know, story of people who were denied the justice of the pension. I'm just going to read you two sections from what is a long poem called "I Will Tell You the Truth About This, I Will Tell You All About It." These are two sections that are kind of like choruses. There are many, many voices. I think they add up to a single coherent story. Excellent sir, my son went in the 54th Regiment. Sir, my husband, who is in Company K, 22nd Regiment, U.S. Colored Troops, and now in the Macon Hospital at Portsmouth with a wound in his arm, has not received any pay since last May, and then only $13. Sir, we, the members of Company D of the 55th Massachusetts Volunteers, call the attention of Your Excellency to our case. For instant, look and see that we never was freed yet. Run right out of slavery, in to soldiery, and we hadn't nothing at all. And our wives and mother, most all of them, is a perishing all about. And we all are perishing ourselves. I am willing to be a soldier and serve my time faithful like a man. But I think it is hard to be put off in such doggish manner as that. Will you see that the colored men fighting now are fairly treated? You ought to do this, and do it at once. Not let the thing run along. Meet it quickly and manfully. We poor oppressed ones appeal to you and ask fair play. So please, if you can do any good for us, do it in the name of God. Excuse my boldness, but please, your reply will settle the matter and will be appreciated by a colored man who is willing to sacrifice his son in the cause of freedom and humanity. I have nothing more to say, hoping that you will lend a listening ear to an humble soldier. I will close yours for Christ's sake. I shall have to send this without a stamp, for I hain't money enough to buy a stamp. I am 60-odd years of age. I am 62 years of age next month. I am about 65 years of age. I reckon I am about 67 years old. I am about 68 years of age. I am on the rise of 80 years of age. I am 89 years old. I am 94 years of age. I don't know my exact age. I am the claimant in this case. I have testified before you two different times before. I filed my claim, I think, first about 12 years ago. I am now an applicant for a pension because I understand that all soldiers are entitled to a pension. I claim pension under the general law on account of disease of eyes as a result of smallpox contracted in service. The varicose veins came on both my legs soon after the war, and the sores were there when I first put in my claim. I claim pension for rheumatism and got my toe broke, and I was struck in the side with the breech of a gun, breaking my ribs. I was a man, stout and healthy, over 27 years of age when I enlisted. When I enlisted, I had a little mustache and some chin whiskers. I was a green boy right off the farm and did just what I was told to do. When I went to enlist, the recruiting officer said to me, "Your name is John Wilson." I said, "No, my name is Robert Harrison." But he put me down as John Wilson. I was known while in service by that name. I cannot read nor write, and I do not know how my name was spelled when I enlisted, nor do I know how it is spelled now. I always signed my name while in the Army by making my mark. I know my name by sound. My mother said, after my discharge, that the reason the officer put my name down as John Wilson was he could draw my bounty. I am the son of Solomon and Lucinda Sibley. I am the only living child of Dennis Campbell. My father was George Jordan, and my mother was Millie Jordan. My mother told me that John Barnett was my father. My mother was Mary Eliza Jackson, and my father, Reuben Jackson. My name on the roll was Frank Nunn. No, sir, it was not Frank Nern. My full name is Dick Lewis Barnett. I am the applicant for pension on account of having served under the name Lewis Smith, which was the name I wore before the days of slavery were over. My correct name is Hiram Kirkland. Some persons call me Harry, and others call me Henry, but neither is my correct name. I think about the work we have to do somehow together as a nation and maybe just also as humans. And it's really, well, you can be scared. Or you can think, okay, it's gonna be beautiful, exciting once we get it together and figure out how to do that. I just had the chance to look in one of the galleries to see the exhibition called Hauling. And it's this beautiful, you know, depiction of work and people pulling every tool you can think of together. And it makes me feel the feeling that thinking about this history and thinking about, you know, what we've got to fix gives me. So I urge you to go through that gallery before you leave if you can, or tomorrow if you can, or sometime. Maybe I'll read a poem that is maybe about that. And it's a funny poem because I don't feel like the kind of lucky poet who gets a lot of freebies, but this was kind of a freebie. I was asleep in Vermont, having a dream that I was in a hotel where a Carl Phillips poem was muraled on a wall, and I was reading it aloud to someone, and then my waking mind said, no, that's not a Carl Phillips poem. That could be your poem. So I woke up and wrote it, and because of the subject matter, I called the poem The Mowers, and it was published that way. And then 2 years ago, I read in Washington, D.C., and I said, oh, this is called Political Poem. So. Political Poem. If those mowers were each to stop at the whim, say, of a greedy thought, and then the one off to the left were to let his arm float up, stirring the air with that wide, slow, underwater gesture, meaning, hello, and you there, aimed at the one more than a mile away to the right. And if he, in his work, were to pause, catching that call by sheer wish, and send back his own slow, one-armed dance, meaning yes, and here, as if threaded to a single long nerve, before remembering his tool and shearing another message into the earth, letting who can say how long graze past until another thought or just the need to know might make him stop and look up again at the other, raising his arm as if to say something like, still and oh, and then to catch the flicker of joy rise up along those other legs and flare into another bright yes that sways a moment in the darkening air. Their work would carry them into the better part of evening, each mowing ahead and doubling back, then looking up to catch sight of his echo, sought and held in that instant of common understanding. The God and speed of it coming out only after both have turned back to face the sea of yet and slow. If they could, and if what glimmered like a fish were to dart back and forth across that wide, wordless distance, the day, though gone, would never know the ache of being done. If they thought to, or would, or even half wanted, their work, the humming human engines pushed across the grass, and the grass, blade after blade, assenting, would take forever. But I love how long it would last. Maybe I'll close with a poem called An Old Story. A lot of the poems in this book, like The Angels and Annunciation, look toward, you know, the biblical source of so much of the myth of America, who we tell ourselves we are. And I wanted to try to write a new myth, something that might be useful thinking forward to what we have to do. So this is called An Old Story. We were made to understand it would be terrible. Every small want, every niggling urge, every hate swollen to a kind of epic wind, livid the land and ravaged like a rageful dream. The worst in us having taken over and broken the rest utterly down. A long age passed, when at last we knew how little would survive us, how little we had mended or built that was not now lost. Something large and old awoke, and then our singing brought on a different manner of weather. Then animals long believed gone crept down from trees. We took new stock of one another. We wept to be reminded of such color. Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Tracy K. Smith, thank you very much for being such a great reader, a wonderful presence here, and just a great advocate and writer of poetry.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about what it's like to be Poet Laureate of the United States. Mm-hmm. Is there a daily responsibility of the POTUS?
Just hauling. No, just kidding. No. Officially, the responsibility is very minimal. You give a reading, you give a lecture. But there are resources to do much more than that. And there's a tradition of activist poets laureate that, inspire me to want to try and do more. So What I've been doing is visiting rural communities in different parts of the U.S. and giving readings like this, but mostly having conversations about poems that are not mine with other people and talking about where the poems take us and what they put us in mind of. Part of that, to me, is about telling people it's not high school, there's no test, and there's not an answer, a right answer predetermined to this poem. I want to hear what you notice. I want to hear how this poem feels useful to you, what questions it raises. And once that sense of stakes is, the high stakes of grading and testing and all of that goes away, there's this wealth of insight that people bring to poems. Even if they don't think they love poetry, they find something useful in the poem that is at hand. I think that's kind of like the part of the brain that sees faces in things that aren't faces. You know, it's probably this old evolutionary capability that keeps you alive in some way. Poems speak to that, I think.
Is there anything that has really surprised you about people and their relationship to poetry that you've discovered as you've been traveling to various places?
Well, having shared a lot of poems that I've loved for some time and having heard perfectly compelling takes on these poems that pull them in a slightly different direction than they've lived for me, I guess I'm just surprised at that resourcefulness that the people bring. I've learned from reading poems with people in prisons and detention centers how a poem about love or heartbreak or family speaks to those things, but it also gives them a new vocabulary for thinking about regret or how to hang on to the real self that they are, that the place that they're in doesn't acknowledge. I did an event with some men in an opioid rehabilitation or rehab center, and they found in a poem about a family, it was a Natalie Diaz poem about a brother who struggles with addiction, and it's this really haunting poem in which the mother, the sister, and the brother are awake at 3 a.m., and the brother is kind of hallucinating. So that was one of the last poems in that space. I didn't want to start with it, but I also thought maybe this could be a good poem for people to kind of grapple with. And somebody said, "This is familiar to me, but what I'm really interested in is that mother. She's awake, she's bearing this weight, and I see my life a little bit differently because of this. I see what I did." And I feel so lucky to be in the presence of such insight and honesty and vulnerability. I wanted to do this project in part because we're told again and again that America's divided, and if you come from different places or you look different from one another, you'll have nothing to say. And I go into these spaces where that mindset tells me I don't belong, and then I have these beautiful connections with people who share and teach me things, and I just feel so lucky to be in that position.
Mm-hmm. What impact, if any, have these travels had on the poetry you're writing now?
Well, that's something I don't know yet. I'm not writing poems at the moment. Having just finished a book, that's not unusual for me. Long breaks, yeah. I have to kind of refill the well or the hopper. Mm. I have to figure out what my new questions are. I need to learn a little something, so I have a new set of terms to wrestle with. And so that's where I am right now. This is going into reserve, and I'm sure it will get processed. I imagine I'll write some poems, but I'm really hoping to write some prose to think about what this project has meant in human terms, in art terms, and then maybe even like politically. So
I think a lot of poets in the audience may find a lot of comfort in the fact that you're saying that you are taking a break from writing, because some of the advice that you get from established poets is
that's good advice. That is good advice. And I think I tell my students that. I did that for years and years. And if I could, I would still. But I have these other things that I'm giving my headspace to. I am working on some other writerly projects. I think I would feel bereft if I weren't. Mm-hmm. So I'm working here and there on some translations and some essays and things like that that help me feel like those muscles are still being trained. But the practical nature of, you know, just life means I have to put that long season where I get to do nothing but write poetry off until it's time. Affords me that privilege.
We're getting some questions from audience members.
I thought you were just like both emailing.
No, I'm not. I hate to
Christmas shopping or something.
It does seem somewhat rude, but I am trying to incorporate you. So I apologize if I'm looking down here. But someone is asking, similar to the sort of things that aspiring poets may be interested in hearing. Tim on Twitter tweeted a question with the hashtag HK Prize, if anybody else is interested. Tim on Twitter said, you say a way to grapple with the present is to look back towards history. What would you say poetry can do to help youth looking to the future?
Well, a poem is an invitation to use a pressurized kind of language, right? To listen and think differently than we do in speech, in everyday life, even in kind of more passive thought. And I think that a poem that is rooted in questions about the future has to do those same things. It has to set out on a path that doesn't exist and find guidance by way of sound and image and impulse and association and whatever else is alive for the poet to make sense. That's, I think, such an exciting act, and it's also very scary. Mm. But when you do it, you sometimes feel that the whatever's happening in language agrees to help you and creates a kind of energy or momentum that, if you choose to, you can kind of submit to and follow. I think poems about the future are important when they acknowledge bleak possibility, and I think it's also important to think about what hope, what the terms of hope might be, and there's probably something between those two poles that I've just set up. So I think it's you know, in some ways, it's what you must do with every poem. I also feel most secure reading poems that allow the speaker to be implicated in whatever the current problem or the perceived problem is. I think about even a poet like Seamus Heaney, who wrote poems about injustice in Ireland and allowed himself to be implicated by ignorance, say, I would have been silent too. Which I think is honest.
Do you find yourself doing a lot of poetry that implicates you?
I try to do that. I hope that's what's happening. When I write a poem in which I'm capable of giving voice to a perspective that I don't think is just, but that fits in my mouth, I feel indicted a little bit. Mm.
Conversely, I mean, you were taking other people's words, people who had the injustice done to them, and sort of shaping them and making them your own in some way. Can you talk a little bit about the process of drawing so deeply on the mm-hmm. historical record for creating that kind of poetry?
Yeah. Well, when I set out to write a poem about the Civil War, I thought I would do my research and then write something in my own voice. But I read these voices that were speaking in compelling, beautiful, dynamic language, and I didn't think it would make sense to overwrite that. So all I did was collect There's so many letters in that poem that are presented pretty much as written and curate. And what I imagine that poem is doing is inviting a reader to come and listen with me. Obviously, my sense of what's important drives that poem, but there's also an exhaustive set of notes at the end of the book that say this person is speaking and this person and this person, and you can find the full account here and here and here, because I think it's a history that's so important, and I hope the poem will send people to it.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from someone along these lines, a question from a teacher at Phillips Exeter who's in the audience, who wrote, my 11th graders are reading Wade in the Water. Tomorrow, we start section two. What advice would you give them about reading poems? What advice would you give them about reading poems about the enslaved? For many of them, this is their first time engaging with slavery.
Uh-huh.
Good question.
I just want to bone up on that section before I answer. Well, I am interested in what the actual voices can teach us about what history feels like on the ground and within an individual life, individual skin, because I was taught history in broad strokes when I was in high school, and things that were really rooted in crazy assumption. The slaves were happy because they were provided for. So I like that varying accounts can give us different terms to consider. I like that poems and literature can take something that might seem abstract and make it human. Even in this poem, every time I read the line, I'm willing to sacrifice my son to the cause of freedom and humanity, and I think this person is enslaved. These are not abstract terms. In his mouth, these are deeply concrete possibilities, and he's fighting for them. To think about how that differs from what a textbook might say, I think is really useful. To think about the distance between different accounts, first and second, third. What else? Then I would ask, well, what does the imagination bring to what we might understand about history? So the long poem I read from, I take it as subjective fact. These are real accounts coming out in the moment. But then there's a poem called The Greatest Personal Privation, which is a real manipulation of historical text on my part. It's a found poem taken from the letters of slaveholders written back and forth to one another about a family of enslaved people who were misbehaving, as far as they saw it. I read those letters, and I wanted to read against that grain. And so I did an erasure or a redaction to see if I could imagine or will myself to hear the voices of the enslaved. So that's a poem that is fiction. What does that gesture suggest about the questions we can ask of history? And what does it remind us has gone missing from most accounts because they have, you know, there aren't records, there aren't archives of, you know, that side of the story in the same way that the plantation owners' lives are thoroughly documented. And then I would also say, if you read that section of the book, read the first poem in the third section. How does that poem, which is rooted in the present tense, change when it's read on the wake of this historical stuff? What common threads exist?
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about writing about some of the more contemporary issues? You wrote one poem about violence in the aftermath of the 2016 election. Is that a different muscle, a different poetic muscle than writing about the historical stuff, or is it part of the same thing?
Well, I'm sure that the some of the sensitivities to language might be different, but that poem is also found in large part, but it's not completely. There's found language within it that comes from different news reports. I imagine I'm doing a similar kind of listening. maybe that poem is almost an amalgam of those two other approaches I just described, one that's documentary and one that is like a willed imagining or reimagining, because there's the voice of the speaker imagining strange theatrical exercise, and then there are these real voices that punctuate the poem. I get excited making a mess like that, you know, moving around within material and trying to hear language and possibility differently, trying to throw things up in the air and then run to the spot where I can catch them and keep going. Mm-hmm. That excites me.
We got a question from an audience member. What part do you see poetry and the humanities more generally playing in social justice movements?
I think in some ways it comes back to that sense of subjectivity, honoring it, honoring the sense of lived experience that animates the questions of policy and citizenship that we're ultimately arguing about. I think that poetry keeps those things close to the ground, where people are. Poetry means that no matter how correct-minded you are, you have to be open to something that can transform your sense of what you're looking at, what you're arguing for. Because in a poem, if you start and end at the same stance, you failed. Maybe that's a great approach for other things too.
To continuously evolve and to shift your feelings on things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to ask you kind of a personal question. It came to me when I was reading your memoir, Ordinary Light, and so much of that book is about faith and about how your faith has evolved over the years. And I was wondering what you think the relationship between your faith, whatever it may be now, and I'm not sure how you would describe your belief system now, your relationship to your faith and also your poetry. Is there a relationship between the two?
Oh, I think so. I feel like the only way I can describe myself is I believe. I like it. In Spanish, they say, "Are you creyente? Do you believe?" Yes, I believe. Life on Mars was a book that helped me to detach that urge from the human-sized sense of God that they had been connected to by my upbringing in church, and attach them to something large, mysterious, yet orderly, like the universe. And I think poetry allows me to even push that wish in different directions and think about, what does a tree know? What is a tree's, you know, sense of purpose, and how can that guide me in this sense that of whatever it is I need to believe we're connected to? I don't know what that denomination is called. So the poetry is an intellectual and a spiritual practice. It's about hope. I mean, I have, both of my parents are gone, and I think about the afterlife a lot, like every day. And poetry gives me different terms for imagining what it is that we are a part of. And other things too, right? Because we're a part of social systems, family systems, private interscapes, and then if you want to get far out, other things possibly too. I mean, it's not prescriptive. I don't think my work is trying to convince anyone of those things, but it's this sort of selfish space where I get to do these thought experiments that somehow make life possible, you know, like that Jane Kenyon poem. Yeah, I will continue to live with this darkness and whatever else sits next to it.
Hmm. What about that process of writing a memoir as opposed to working on poems? How would you compare the two as far as you approach them?
I really loved the process of writing prose. I like writing prose, but it's really so scary for me too. And writing, setting out to write what I knew would probably have to be hundreds of pages without a real sense of what it was heading toward was scary, because I'm used to saying, okay, I'll get to the bottom of this page and see what I have. But it was also a great way of having to stretch out, having to stay put, having to resist the urge to leap away from the topic at hand and to think in, you know, like metaphor and corollaries. With the prose that I was seeking to write, I needed to build layer upon layer upon layer that helped me to see what these different periods of my life were about. And it's like scary to think I might do something like that again.
Really?
I mean, to think, oh, okay, what are we looking at? 6 years? Hundreds of pages that just get trashed. But I have questions.
Was it more or less satisfying as a process than writing poetry?
It was just different.
Just different?
It was just different.
I think some folks here are excited that you might be doing it again. You say,
yeah. Yeah, we'll see. I continue to have questions.
Well, that's a good thing. Having questions is a good thing. Let's talk a little bit about the slowdown. We have some fans of the slowdown here. Yes, good. All right.
So there's one person.
One slowdown. Count me among
Share
them.
Share it with your friends.
I can't think of a better name for that particular segment, because mm-hmm. it does force you to slow down. And of course, it gives you a chance also for listeners to get to know you right at the outset, a little bit of an autobiography at the beginning. How did you conceive of the idea of the slowdown? What made you want to do something like this?
I feel like we are so rushed. We live in this like crazy clip. We live at a clip. And we kind of skim across the surface of things. We agree with people after we've read the first few sentences of whatever they've said. We affirm our own immediate reactions, because as consumers, that's what we've been trained to do. And I don't quite like that. Mm. I feel like we are so much larger, deeper, ageless than the mode in which we're currently living suggests. Poetry is one of the things that makes me certain of that, and it also is one of the things that helps me to practice that, you know, to slow down, to look closely, to look again, to open myself up to another set of experiences, and to learn a new vocabulary for the possibility that I might be open to. And I wanted to, I just wanted to believe that other people want that too. I also am such a believer that poetry, is something we need, even though some of us are afraid of it or think it's not interesting. And so I wanted to say there's so many amazing poems, that speak in so many different ways to all the different feelings that come from being alive. And all you need is a few minutes to listen to one and think about it.
Mm-hmm. So what is your hope for the segment? Are you hoping that it will be picked up by public radio stations like NHPR?
Yeah, there are a few that have picked it up, I think, beginning in January. So it'll be out there in space and time on the airwaves soon, which I'm so excited about, because I love the medium of radio. It feels so intimate, so immediate. So, you know, I know that these things are archived, but it also, you feel so lucky when you're in the right time to catch something that speaks to you. So I'm excited about that. But I hope it might just give people another mode to kind of tap into during the course of a day when there are lots of other demands that are being made.
Mm-hmm. Is podcasting and spoken word in general kind of a natural evolution of the art form of poetry?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like a lot of poets have podcasts, and it's a great way of sometimes showcasing poems, but what I'm noticing is more often getting to the backside, being able to talk about what's on the poet's mind, how the poet's engagement with the art form also speaks to other things like life and the world. And so I'm really enjoying that. I'm really into verses right now, the S with Danez Smith and Franny Choi, two younger, brilliant poets. There's a lot going on. I'm excited that there are so many people who are reinvigorating even the performance aspect of poetry. There was a time when I was coming of age where there was like this big wall between poems written on the page and poems written for performance, and then I witnessed that sort of dissolution of that. I think now what we're witnessing is this explosion of possibilities from both elements or areas, enlarging poetry itself, enabling it to speak to the world and selfhood, and to kind of change our ear for language and what it is, and that happens in real time.
Well, this should be my last question. And since part of this may be broadcast, I want to ask you to speak for a moment to the people who haven't experienced the wonders of poetry yet, who have heard about it, who remember it from high school and maybe go, eh. So to those people, make your case. Why should... Why should those of us who are, you know, they might enjoy it, but they haven't tried it in a long time. Why should they pick up a poem, or and if so, where should they start?
I think that the feelings that we live with and that move and define and unsettle us most powerfully are the ones that are the most difficult to name and describe. If you say, I'm angry, that doesn't cut it. I love, that's not precise enough. I'm scared, it doesn't really do enough to say why, how, and what strange, almost unlikely way those feelings are part of your life. And so poetry allows language to become extra resourceful in service of naming and making sense of those things. Poetry says we can't get there by a straight line. There's not a, you know, prefabricated description of what's real for you, but if we compare it to this other thing, the love that you had, if you compare it to war, you're getting a little closer, you're getting warmer. The children that you live with, if we think about zoology, we're getting warmer. And so poetry is about a useful kind of distortion of language so that it brings it in closer alignment with what we really feel. And if you can name something and describe it, then you can live with it a little bit better.
Well, Tracy K. Smith, thank you very much for speaking with me, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And congratulations on being this year's recipient of the Hall Kenyon Prize. Before you hit the road this evening, I want to let those in the audience know that everyone is welcome to attend the reception afterwards in the Courier's beautiful winter garden space. Coffee, tea, cookies available. And a reminder to everyone, books are available for purchase in the winter garden. Michael Herman from Gibson's Bookstore has a variety of titles for sale from Tracy, also from Wes McNair, Donald Hall, Jane Kenyon. All of that's upstairs. Tracy and Wes will be signing their books, so thank you both for doing that. That's really nice of you. Before we close the program, I do want to thank our event host for the evening, the Courier Museum of Art. Been a wonderful host here. Thanks also to the NHPR planning team. Have put a ton of work into this, and it's gone really, really well. Thank you very much. A reminder, you can tune to NHPR to hear more great literary and arts-related programming. We are on air online and at nhpr.org. You can also follow us on social media sites like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You can learn more about what's happening in our state and the world. We are grateful for your support in attending this evening, and we look forward to seeing you again next time. Thank you very much.